convention that Joe will be.
Bob Bird rejoining us. Bob was kind enough to come in about a week ago now, I think a week to the day, in fact, and talk some about the Stehekin Valley. We intended to cover it all in one day, and I think we got to about 1,900 or so. So, Bob, we want to thank you for volunteering to come back with us. I guess a good starting point, Bob, would be to just briefly recap some of the earlier history of the Stehekin Valley, and then we'll move on from there.
Okay. One of the interesting things that about Stehekin to start with was there was a man by the name of Horton, and we don't know very much about this man, except that he came up there apparently in 1886, and he had come from Minnesota, and he had been an Indian agent back there, and there may have been some connection with him knowing that that was the year that the Stehekin Valley ceased to be, or the northeast part of the valley ceased to be part of the Indian reservation. At any rate, he built a house, or just a cabin to start with, on the lake there, and he was there when the artist came through in 89, and I read the forest fire account last week. That was Horton's cabin that they tried to save from the fire there. Horton later built a cabin up near, or some kind of a building up near Boulder Creek. Part of it's still there to this day, and it's been a mystery why he ever built it there. His original cabin is gone. Later also, the family built another house down by what we call Cunningham Castle, and just a few of the bricks and so forth you can still see on the ground there. At any rate, Horton kept writing about the mining surge up there to his brother, I think it was his nephew, George Hall. Now, George Hall, I think, was running a starch factory in Minnesota, and he had a flourishing business there. At any rate, Horton convinced him to sell out and come to Stehekin. So he came up there, and he first built his house, which ultimately became part of Fields Hotel. And then that became sort of a stopping place for miners coming and going. And George Hall was coming and going to the upper country, and his wife and children were living there in his house. So George Hall ultimately sold. He started to expand in 92 his house into more of a hotel. He put a couple of wings on it with porches, two-story wings. They weren't large, but everybody was hunting a place to stay, so he was like more enlarging to take care of these visitors.
You know, Bob, last week I saw a picture of Mr. Hall's hotel. One thing that really strikes you is today we consider a hotel business someplace that builds for decor and is concerned about the competition and sort of out gussying them up. He certainly was building that thing by the looks of the picture, fully knowing that no one else was going to be there to out gussy him up. Well, it's not a fancy looking place at all.
That's true, all right. He had a house, and then he needed some more rooms, so he tacked some rooms on, and then he needed a porch, so he tacked a porch on. And besides, we got to get going here with something. So that's sort of the way it was. Field bought out, I think, in 93, and then in 93 he began to expand that building considerably more. It was after that that he built the Field Hotel as a separate building, and then this older building was moved over adjacent to that later and called the Annex, and became a part of it, although it had originally been a separate building. At any rate, we can't hardly imagine the surge of people that were coming into the Stehekin country, or into this whole country, but especially the Stehekin country during those years. There was absolutely swarms of people. In March of 93, there were swarms of people coming over Cascade Pass from the Skagit Valley down into the head of Bridge Creek. And that's the reason that this this store and post office had been established up there. And the upper country in Stehekin was the place everybody was headed for. When you went up lake, you you ended up at the head of the lake at night, and then you headed up valley as fast as you could, and Bridge Creek was really the center of everything up there then.
That's a good point that you raised, the people who were coming over Cascade Pass to Stehekin. What percentage of the visitors to Stehekin in the 1890s would have been getting there without coming through the Chelan or Lake Park Lakeside area?
Well, I don't know the percentage. I know that they were going up the Methow and down Bridge Creek as well, because you had these bunches of prospectors and miners looking over the country, and in mixed in with them were just plain visitors. Although the visitors were looking to see what was going on, they might want to become a part of it.
Would there have been a time in those days when Stehekin would have been a larger community than anything down at this end of the lake?
Well, at that time, Bridge Creek was, of course, the people were all over the hills, camping out and prospecting and coming and going. But Bridge Creek itself was laid out as a town site before Stehekin was. Stehekin was a little bit later.
Okay.
You had the... Then after these years, 1893, the price of silver dropped down to 68 cents an ounce. And that was kind of... beginning of the end for a lot of things, although at Stehekin there had been so many discoveries and there was still lots of country that people were exploring, and there's absolutely hundreds, probably a couple thousand prospect holes or mines up in that country. And you can imagine the amount of men it would take to explore and find all of that, to keep up the assessment and so forth. Of course, this was over into the head of Railroad Creek, Upper Agnes, and Upper Bridge Creek, hole everywhere, Upper Thunder Creek on the other side. In fact, is there still silver mining over on the Thunder Creek area, trying to build a road in for consolidate all their mines and operate them now. At any rate, there was lots of visitors coming, but the early search slowly died. More and more visitors were always coming. And after Hall, Mr. Field started to build his hotel, it was for both kinds of people. Incidentally, he called it the Argonaut Hotel. Other people call it the Field Hotel, but to him it was the Argonaut. He advertised it as the Argonaut. You could come up there and hunt your own golden fleece up there in the boondocks.
All right.
Ultimately, he brought this to, 50 rooms. The Field had this till about, 1916, and the Great Northern Railroad bought this. One of the interesting things, and you can get this book at the library, is called Tenting Tonight. It has the account of the Reinhardt trip. She was a well-known author in those days, and she was hired by the Great Northern Railroad to come up to Stehekin, make this trip, and write up the story and publicize the area. They also sent at least one artist up there, and he went clear to the top of the peaks of Horseshoe Basin and drew a magnificent etching of the area there, looking down into the valley, and you can see Mount Rainier in the distance. And Mr. Britt, who had the newspaper here, had this printed, and it was sold all over. And the railroad advertised people could come from anywhere, way back east, round trip ticket clear up to Stehekin, for all the prices included in one price, and see the country. They were pushing this then.
A lot of people have asked me when I mentioned you could go to Grand Central Station and buy a ticket to Stehekin, they'd say, well, wait a minute. The railroad ended before it got here. What kind of trip would that have entailed?
Well, the railroad was coming through Wenatchee by 92, and this trip included from Wenatchee hotel accommodations and steamboat trip across up the river staying overnight at Camel's or Darnell's or wherever here, and included staying the boat trip up lake and everything. It was all one package trip. And the Great Northern was pushing this. We forget that the Great Northern has other places like this. They also developed Glacier Peak National Park. It, up until just a few years ago, was all owned by the Great Northern Railroad. They also developed Sun Valley, which is still in operation.
Bob, some of these early miners, when those fellows were up there and they found a little something that they thought it might have been gold, where did they go for assaying and that kind of thing? What kind of support services were available to them?
Well, there was immediately assay services. There was one at Bridge Creek and there was one at Meadow Creek. I have an old picture of the assay office. It's nothing but a kind of a fancy tent. And there's maybe 200-300 pounds of little sacks of ore stacked by the door, and it says assay office right over the door. And you see the table set up inside for taking
nothing
care.
Too permanent, though.
No, it wasn't, but you could get it right then and there.
Right. What happened to that area then in the wintertime?
Well, the wintertime, mostly, for the most part, everybody got snowed out. However, Bridge Creek, people stayed there some all winter. And, of course, it's Tehekin. People stayed around there all winter. Later on, some of the mines were actually operated all winter, the ones that had gone far enough underground. The one up in Horseshoe Basin did, one winter at least.
Okay, we're talking this morning with Bob Bird, live from the Apple Cup Cafe, Radio Lake Chelan's Month of Heritage. We're going to take a commercial break, and we'll be back in a moment. Thank you, Steve. Bob Bird is our guest, and we talked with Bob a bit last week about some of the earlier days in the Stehekin Valley, and I mean going back to the early part of the 1800s, but today we're going to move a little bit forward from that. Bob, let's take a look at things as they might have been around the turn of the century. When the 20th century dawned, can you give us a sort of a thumbnail sketch of what the Stehekin Valley would have been like then?
Well, it was right around the turn of the century was really a slowing down of what we've been talking about, but it was very prominent yet. An interesting thing was that about that time, I think it was 1900 or about then, or just prior to then or right after, that the Buckner family was already in the valley, but there were several members in the family. And there was Henry Buckner, who was very interested in the work up there, and he went up to Bridge Creek and built his own hotel at Bridge Creek. It wasn't very large, maybe 6 or 8 rooms, and had a large dining room, and he hired, I think in 1900, Lydia George to come up and cook for him and take care of his little daughter. And there was plenty of business around there to take care of this hotel. Of course, a lot of people were still coming in to do their assessment work and prospecting. And the Lower Valley, there wasn't as many people actually settling in there, although there is the old places where people originally settled and were more or less coming back to, or coming and leaving, or other people were selling, buying it from them, and so on. So it's kind of these slack years for a little while. This is the time of the Reinhardt trip, a little later, and leads up to the time when Field sold out to the Great Northern, and it's more the dying of the prospecting, slowly, and the emphasis is more on just visitors and people living in the valley. Homesteaders.
Okay, now we've talked about the Field Hotel, the hotel that Buckner built. Were there other hotel accommodations up there?
Well, up there, there was also the Vollmers. They called their place the Stehekin Lodge. And it, like some of the places, and then there was the Purple Place. They were similar. They were a house, but they took in boarders. Some of them, Purples, had tent cabins out for the summertime, but they cooked for people, and people could stay there. The Vollmers was locally called the Pennsylvania Lawyer, and I don't know very much about him. He has a very beautifully built house, or lodge, set out where the lake is now raised. Purples was there. Purples later became the Golden West Lodge, which was built after tearing down a Fields Hotel when the lake was raised. There was then the other hotels down along the lake. Morris Hotel continued up until it burned, I think, in 56 or so. And there was the early Lucerne Hotel over at Railroad Creek. It's long gone. And Gray's Lodge at Meadow Creek. So all of these places were places where people could stay, eat, and get accommodations.
Here in the lower end of the lake, there was quite a rivalry that developed between the town of Lake Park, which is now Lakeside, and Chelan, and Chelan Falls, even some degree of rivalry. Was there that kind of thing between Bridge Creek and Stehekin and the Lucerne area?
Well, there wasn't so much between Bridge Creek and Stehekin, because it was about a day's trip between them. So there wasn't that much of a rivalry. There was more between, well, not really rivalry, because they were separated further apart than down here. But visitors had a choice of where to go, and different ones were advertising the best points of their particular place.
All right, in the early part of this century, we had then several places where a tourist could go, several places where he could rest his weary bones. What did he do when he rested them? What was there to do as a tourist?
Well, tourists coming up here primarily came just to loaf and play around, but they were out taking trips on horses all over the hills, looking at somebody's prospect, and of course, fishing was absolutely fantastic, and when a hotel needed some fish, well, you went and caught you some fish, and there was plenty to be caught. It was just marvelous fishing, and just getting in a rowboat, rowing around the lake and seeing somebody else's house, going to visit them down the lake or up the lake. You didn't used to row, you pulled.
Let's talk a little bit about the fishing. Now when people think of Lake Chelan fishing, I think they think of silvers. What did they think of then?
Well, there weren't any silvers then, but it was cutthroat trout was one of the great favorites, and later on, during all this time, the Game Commission had fish traps all over the valley, and they were catching these and spawning them and shipping the spawn or the fry out to other parts of the state. This is one place that there were lots of them. There was also Dolly Varden, which they called bull trout in those days. And then they had these same, we call them the freshwater cod. They call them Malma then. And brook trout were common in certain areas. They'd already developed in Bridge Creek as a kind of a place you could catch them. It was about these four main kinds of trout in their valley, in the lake then. There was another called lake trout, and different people, not sure what somebody might have called somebody else's kind of fish, a lake trout. Some of the early catches strung out on logs. You see pictures of people laying all their fish out and taking a picture on a log. There's some beautiful catches, or teachers came up and strings of fish hung up to show what people had caught.
Where would people catch these fish? Could you just throw your line in anywhere and catch them?
Yes, everywhere, just everywhere. One of the early riders coming to the lower lake here saw where they were actually commercially catching fish and selling them to some of the restaurants around, like Waterville had a standing order for fish out of the lake. And he mentions that sooner or later these folks are going to run out of fish in this lake. They don't believe it now, but they will, he said.
if you can, how about the fish hatchery? I understand that the fish hatchery in that area was one of the very first in the state, was it not?
Well, it was the first trout hatchery in the state. I think 1903. I'm not sure of that, but I think that's when it was built, and it wasn't tremendously large. But it got its water out of Little Boulder Creek, and it sat out up valley and a little north and east, I think, of Fields Hotel. And for years and years and years, this was used. Incidentally, after they raised the lake and all of that had to be moved, what we call the present community hall across the road from the Stehekin Log School is another fish hatchery that they built and was operated after that for the same purpose, is to catch cutthroat.
So would the two have been operating at the same time?
No. Okay. No, they were separate.
What kind of operation would that have been, I wonder? I don't know what a modern fish hatchery looks like, but I would assume it would be a lot different than the one we have now down here.
Well, I remember as a kid, the one being operated across from the school, that was where I got some of my fish education, was going over and on the men kindly showing the process of the little eggs hatching and the little eyes showing up and on and on. But all it was 2x12 tarred flumes with the water running in one end and ultimately out the other, full of screens, and then there was individual that you could pick up these individual trays, and the eggs were put into these and the water just ran through them, and they were full of these trays, all of these flumes were, so the water ran in one end and out the other, and the fish were hatched in the trays in the running water. That's really about all there was to it. There was just a number of these trays, and then you could walk between them and take care of them. And there, one end of the building was sort of shut off where they had stuff stored. It's all open, though, outdoors.
Yeah. Talking about Stehekin in the very early 1900s, would the fishing gear that the fishermen used then have been any different than it is now?
Well, I suppose it roughly the same. Trolling in the lake was one of the ways that they fished early, and we still do also. It's an easy way, and of course, bait fishing and fly fishing is much the same, I presume.
I would imagine that the first gas-powered boat up there would have been quite a revolution.
I suppose it was. I don't recall. That was before my day, of course, but I remember one incident that I've heard tell about that there was a tremendous harangue over. I don't know if it was the first gas boat that came up lake, but it was one of the early ones, and when they got up there, apparently somebody on one of the work hands on the boat had handled some gas, and he had the gas smell on his hands and clothes, and then he handled a bunch of fresh meat and tried to deliver it, and as soon as they got it, they smelled the gas on the meat, and they wouldn't accept the meat, and they said that there was nothing the matter with it except a little gas spilled on, and on they had a great harangue out on the dock.
We're talking this morning with Bob Burt, live from the Apple Cup Cafe on Radio Lake Chelan's Month of Heritage, and we're going to take a commercial break and talk some more with Bob in just a minute. Thank you, Steve. We are again talking from the Apple Cup Cafe with Bob Burt today. Bob, a while ago we were mentioning the Field Hotel, and I think you mentioned that it was sold to the Great Northern Railroad. When did Mr. Keel do that, and why would he have done that?
Well, we're going to raise the lake, and Great Northern was going to use the power to run electric trains with, so he was going to have to tear it down. And the fact is, everyone up there had to sell their land around the lake to preparing to raise the lake.
As I recall, that would have been in the early 19-teens when the railroad was considering doing that.
Well, I don't have much of the history on the years of all it when they were thinking about this and when they actually did it, but I think it was 1916 that Field sold out, and after that it was under several different managers. Some people in the name of Regan and Baker, I think, took over right after him. I don't know whether they put in managers or not, and I'm not quite sure whether Jack was just a manager, Jack Blankenship, or whether he actually got bought it. He bought it later, or got it later at least, but there were a number of managers there. See, Jack Blankenship was the first ranger, Forest Service ranger, to come into Stehekin. He'd come from the Lake Wenatchee area. And he was the ranger up there for a good many years. And he began to really like the place and love it. So when they actually raised the lake, or were preparing to, he bought the old Field Hotel. And at first they were only going to raise the lake 11 feet. So he began to move the buildings back up toward what now we call Morse's Resort, or the River Resort there. And he had a big section of this moved up there and starting to set it together again when they decided they were going to raise another 10 feet. So in the process, he had to take it all off of there. So then he traded this land, or he traded the hotel and the land that he'd had there apparently, for the Purple Point, or where the present landing buildings are down there. The railroad apparently had already purchased all that land as well. So he made this trade, and then he had to tear it all down and to move it across the lake and put it back up over there, which he did, and got it in operation by the spring of 1927 as the lake raised. The Golden West Lodge was in operation when the first boat docked down there when the lake was raised. He built a couple of cabins below there and a house behind it and a shop. Jack loved to work with timber, especially logs, and he'd done this from a boy in Lake Wenatchee area. So this became the first buildings over there. He tore down the Purple's house. It sat just about where the lodge is now. So this is the Golden West Lodge, and it operated then, and the building is still there.
Now, in the teens, when the railroad was considering building a dam here and that kind of thing, did it affect other properties up there as well, any of these other hotels that we mentioned, for instance?
Oh, yes. Fields, Morris Hotel, it came, the lake raised right up to the 6 inches of the floor, level to the porch. There was a big squabble over that because railroad said they didn't flood the hotel, so therefore they didn't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
But ultimately they did, and it was torn down and rebuilt. And
The railroad plan, I know, to build a major hydro plant here was sort of demolished by World War I when their priorities got changed for them and so on. But what kind of prices would they have been paying for land up there in the teens when they went and bought it? Do you have any idea?
No, I don't. I don't know what that would be.
I often wondered if they would have been paying higher than what the normal market value might have been, or, you know, what kind of hassles may have occurred there. But because I know that it didn't show up very prominently at all in the local newspaper. But at any rate, so the railroad buys the property. Obviously, the railroad had gotten rid of a good deal of it. They must have taken some, when their plans changed and they couldn't put the dam in, there must have been a lot of jockeying or land trading going on in the ensuing 10 or 12 years before the dam was actually built.
Well, I think there was. I don't know whether they formed the Chelan Electric Company or if that was formed by others later. That was the one who actually got a hold of all the land by the time the lake was raised and did the work. So, and later it was sold to the PUD and so forth.
Were there many changes there in the Stehekin Valley through the early part of this century, the first 20 years of it? Any significant changes?
Well, a great change, of course, was in Raise the Lake. That meant that the old Stehekin was erased. It just wasn't there anymore. And the new Stehekin began to form around Blankenship's Hotel. In fact, it is the same year that he built that hotel. There was a man by the name of Hank Bowen, who was a nephew of a man who had settled in the valley 6 miles up years before. And he came and I think must have just leased land from Jack and built a little store and a post office right where the present dining room part of the cafe is there. And he ran this for a few years. He built a house behind there. Then Jack built what we for years called the White House building. This is some more lumber from the Fields Hotel that was set right where the present Alpine House or Botel part of the landing place is there. Then Mr. Bowen left, and Jack's wife had passed away, and he married Burl, and she set up a little store and a post office in the bottom of this White House. Then Jack built the log part of the cafe. You can't tell the difference now, but right adjacent to that then, which was used for many, many years, up until the war, I guess. And right after the war, then Jack had passed away, and my Uncle Kurt and Burl had married, and they built the dining room part onto this, and ultimately then the motel units and so forth. So this area became the new Stehekin. Also, Jack, before he passed away, had a mortgage on the hotel buildings, and he couldn't pay for this, so the Millers took over that and got a lot of his other land in the process. He continued to own what we call the landing area. But then they built more cabins up at the hotel area, and later sold that to a string of different people owned the part up there. Then they moved over and started to build what we call Swissmont Lodge, which is relatively recent, and Pete Miller ran that until he sold out to Mr. Michelson and him to the Park Service, and so that's the new Stehekin all down there. But the old Stehekin is all erased. You go up on the hill and try to look in low water, and you just cannot see a single trace of anything out there. A little piece of an old road you can see, and that's all.
Bob, in the teens and 20s here in this end of the valley, things went pretty much as they did economically for the rest of the country. But there were some significant changes here. We had the Manson area came into full bloom with its expansion of orchards going in with the irrigation system there and so on. And, of course, in the 20s, you had the great boom years for the whole country economically. Was the Stehekin Valley too remote to be affected by any of those trends elsewhere, or was it affected?
Well, I grew up, of course, in the Stehekin area during the Depression time, and I was young then. I didn't know there was a Depression. I thought this is the way you lived.
Yeah.
But, of course, we had a ranch, and everybody had a few cows and chickens and pigs and had a big garden and worked for the Forest Service or trapped in the winter or sold wood or picked apples for Buckner's. Buckner's had the only large producing orchard up there, and they'd worked on this from the early days. It was a fair-sized orchard, much larger than it is presently. They've not near as much of it as there once was. And it was quite an operation. So this is the kind of life that I knew as we were growing up, and people were still homesteading. My father's homesteaded, one of the late ones. The fact is, my mother is the only remaining early homesteader that's still alive, original homesteady, the old-timers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I grew up, there were just about the same population up there as there is now, except that now we have so many more of the government men living there that Forest Service didn't have nearly so many government men, although in the summertime they had lots of people working lookouts, but trail work was all under contract, and that's something that the local men worked at in the summer.
Mm-hmm. How about the Forest Service in those days? I would imagine that it was the major outside presence in that area in the 20s and 30s, wasn't it?
Well, it was, but it was no tremendous big deal. They did have a ranger station at Stehekin. Jack Blankenship, I mentioned, was the first ranger, but when he got involved with the hotel, he tried to be a ranger and run that too, and they didn't like that idea, so he had to decide, and he quit being ranger. And then there was Mr. Wright, and then Mr. Weeman came along, whose girls went to school with me in the log school when I was young. So it was mostly the lookouts in the summer, and they had graded the road and worked trails. But that was it started to be under contract later, I guess. Early days, it was hired directly by the Forest Service. But these were just small crews going out, repair trails, and some building of trails, putting up telephone lines to lookouts, and that type of thing. There were a few small forest fires and a few very large ones, or pretty large ones, that happened during those early years.
One of the largest fires ever in this area was in 1927. It burned, I know, on the north shore of the lake. Did that fire in any way affect the Stehekin Valley?
Well, that one didn't, but I remember when I was very young, I don't know which fire this was, but it may have been on Company Creek Ridge, back of our place, very high, that there was a large fire. And I remember the smoke getting so thick that at one time my mother got very worried because you couldn't tell where the fire was, and with the smoke coming from the fire just a little ways away or way off, and worried about whether we'd better skedaddle or not. But the smoke cleared, it remained very high, and we never left.
I would think that that there would be a tendency in heavy snow winters, or in cases of forest fires or whatever, especially then, that one might have tended to get a little bit nervous living in the Stehekin Valley. It wasn't that easy a thing to get out of there, was it?
Well, we never worried about getting out of there. People coming now are used to living in town, and they say, what about a doctor? Well, never occurred to me that I needed to live next door to a doctor. My sister got sick with pneumonia once, and we thought she was going to die, and this is the middle of winter. I remember Dad sending down lake, and the doctor came up, and they snowshoed hard to get in there to our house after dark, and he was all in, not used to snowshoeing, but he stayed overnight and told us she had pneumonia, she was very sick, and left some pills for her and so on, and left. And my sister was sick, I think, for maybe a month, and one of the amusing thing about this, it was that when she got well enough to get up off of the bed, my mother took the whole bed apart to air it, and there were all of her pills under the mattress. And And boy, did she get it, except that she was too sick to really get it. We laugh about this to this day. She got well without the pills.
We're talking this morning with Bob Bird, talking live from the Apple Cup Cafe. I want to thank the folks for the Apple Cup for hosting us again this year. And we'll come back and talk some more with Bob in a moment. Thank you, Steve. Bob, we've talked quite a bit about Fields Hotel, about a little bit about Moore Point, especially last week when you were here. But one of the names that pops to my mind a lot when I look at records of the Valley and such is the Rainbow Lodge. What were its origins?
Well, the origins of the Rainbow Lodge, Buckner's had been up there for a number of years, and part of the family was concentrating on the Buckner Ranch. But there was Henry Buckner, who was concentrating on Bridge Creek and the mines. But his brother, he was a brother of Van, and Van had given him a piece of ground off of the Down Valley farm, and he had built a house there. And part of the time he stayed there, but he became sickly in 1910, and he died there at the house that year. And he, in his will, willed the land to Lydia George, who had been working for him for years and had been taking care of his daughter and took care of him while he was sick. So Lydia George ended up with this property. Now, her sister had been coming for years, Althea Rice, to help her and continued to do so. So following this, they had the place there, but I don't know if they did a whole lot to it for quite a while, although they may have rented out rooms occasionally, because in 1917 we have an account of one of the teachers staying there, but it had been closed that year during the winter time. So she came up especially to open it for the teacher, which started teaching in very early spring that year. The school, however, wasn't where it presently is. It was up what we call the Cronk Cabin on the Stanley Place. That's where she hiked to school each day from there. But it was in 1923, just before the raising of the lake, that Lydia hired a man by the name of Jameson to come up there and build a barn and four cabins, I think. And they began to develop a little tourist trade. They served meals in the house. They had an old Ford truck, and they put seats in the back of the truck. And this continued clear up to World War II, when it ceased operations. However, in my growing up years, I remember this Ford truck bus going to and from the landing, picking up people at the boat landing. What ones didn't go up to the Golden West Lodge, and riding up there, going up to Rainbow Falls and back, all you could eat for lunch, and back to the boat. While the boat was in, you get all that for a dollar. I never will forget the hullabaloo in the valley when everybody thought how outrageous it was when they raised the price to $1.25 for all of that.
Times do change, don't they?
Another interesting thing about this in the upper country, when Mr. Henry Buckner passed away, he had had a Mr. Stinson working for him for years, and apparently, at least the last year, because of his passing away or whatever happened, I don't know, but he didn't get paid. So Mr. Stinson filed a labor lien against Henry Buckner's holdings, and ultimately obtained all of them, I guess, which included the Bridge Creek area where the hotel was. And he no longer took care of people up there, I don't think, but he lived there and came up all summers, all the time I was a kid, they came up. He was doing assessment work on his properties, and I wouldn't doubt he was doing it on hire for other properties as well. But you see, the early people who came up there and prospected were slowly passing away or selling their properties on, and the interest slowly died, and there never was transportation to get ore out of those places. The old prospectors high-graded as they were building the tunnel, but they were, so you see the sacks of ore coming out on a pack string, and mostly for assay and to show their worth. But these fellows were going all over the world, trying to find financial backing to sell out to someone like House on Mine,
to consolidate all of these claims and actually put in a mine up there. There are, I think, at one time a reading that there were 23 silver lead glenotype veins running through the mountains up there in one part. And many of these mines were cross-cutting these veins at different levels, and some of them go clear through the mountain. To this day, they're there, although some of them are sort of caved in and so on, but this ore and these prospect holes are still all over the country up there for those who wanted to hunt them up. But eventually, the older people died and passed on, and these became defunct, and so that even Mr. Stinson ultimately didn't come back anymore, and so much of that has just ceased to operate.
Could I still go up there as a tourist and take a pan with me and find a gold nugget here or there?
Well, I don't think you'd find any gold up there. No one, I don't know of. It's primarily a silver lead galena type ores in that part of the country. Mm-hmm. There is an old Indian tale about gold, but nobody knows exactly where it came from or if it ever even came from up there.
It seemed to me that Lieutenant Pierce, in his report of 1882, made some mention of someone telling him about a great ledge of gold, or maybe it was silver, I don't know.
Well, there's two places where this is mentioned. One is in the pass, in Warwick Pass, over from the twist, the head of, right behind Stehekin. And the other place is the other side of Cascade Pass as you go down the other side. Mm-hmm. And they are mining there today, there and in Thunder Creek. There are crews, people working there in the summer now.
If I were to go up there as a tourist today, is it difficult to see evidence of the old mining attempts and so on?
It's not difficult, but it's all overgrown. If someone points it out to you, it's obvious. But you can walk right by some things. Not even notice they're there. Incidentally, this isn't a mining hole, but one of my most amazing experiences of myself when I was a kid was, went up to Stinson's, and I don't know if it's a picnic, Valley sometimes went on picnics up there, or if we went up to visit, which we did sometimes, but I remember going fishing, which was just, the buildings were right on the stream. I was out there fishing along and going up through the brush along the side of the creek, and as I pulled in my pole and started to go through some brush, I turned around and there was a great big hole in the ground there, or the side of me, it wasn't in the ground, and I was dumbstruck. It was huge. It was like as big as a living room, or bigger. And I parted the brush and walked back in there a little bit, and then I was further dumbstruck to see a table sitting there, and on the table was fresh butter and milk and jars of things in there, sitting there to cool. And that was Stinson's cooler. And the house, of course, was just up above and on top. But then later, I found out that Henry Buckner had started to build this. It never was finished. But it's on a point of land, and the river goes right by the entrance to it, around this point, and is much lower on the other side. So he was going to flow the river through there, put a great wheel on there, and have all the power in the world to do anything he wanted with. But it just never was finished. But it's still there. But You can walk right by it and not see it. That's pointed out to you.
That is fascinating. You mentioned growing up there in the Depression years. Again, was the Stehekin Valley remote enough, isolated enough that its lifestyle would not have been affected by the Depression as much as other places?
Well, I say I grew up there thinking this is the way the world was. Mm-hmm. We're very amused. Now the people coming up there as a visitor, they get off and they say, the first thing they usually say is, how did all the cars get here? Because they notice there's no road up there. Well, when I was a kid and we came down lake, that was our first explanation. How did all the cars get down here? We never saw so many cars in our lives. When I was a kid, we came, I might have come out of the valley, I don't know, every two or three years maybe. It was a tremendous, exciting experience to come down downtown those days, and we were just hicks from the sticks, no doubt, and everything was a brand new experience. And I was about maybe 10 or 11. We came down once and went to the show and saw Rin Tin Tin. And oh my goodness, what an experience that was. See a trained dog doing all those things. And we rode the stage down to Wenatchee, all the winding road. And one of the things that we weren't used to riding up there, at least anywhere near these incredible speeds down here. And we almost always got car sick. We just weren't used to it.
Yeah. When you'd come out as a youngster, was that a trip that would be well planned? Would you know you were going to go to the show at this hour and tomorrow do this and that kind of thing? Or?
Well, this time that I recall, I remember having something in the matter of my eyes, and I had come down to see the doctor. I may have come down another time to have my teeth worked on, another time to visit a friend at Chelan Falls, which is where I spent a week, and could not find anything to do down here in this country. I was too used to just playing with all outdoors up there and didn't know what this outdoors was.
Yeah.
Learned to ride a bike down there, or tried to. I had a terrible time because I didn't know how to do it. But Stehekin was a very separate kind of a way of life as I grew up. I have some old diaries of my dad's, and I'm amazed yet to read how everybody hiked everywhere to do everything all the time. No matter what they were doing, they were trading butter or milk between one another, or ran out of kerosene for the kerosene lamp, and you went up and borrowed a gallon, and dad's little account book of 5 cents for this and 10 cents for that. And of course, in the wintertime, while everybody skied, and we were always inventing a new kind of ski wax for more, better ways so that you didn't have to wax so often and all kinds of things like that. It was just a way of life that town people were just, it was very, very different.
Did each family that lived there have their own horticultural setup? Could you live on what you grew and raised in terms of livestock and so on?
Well, we always did. Most of the people there, you somehow made enough of your own things on, or grew enough things on your own place to survive, to fill a shelter for the winter, and then working out what time there was to work. And then in the part of the years, there was the evolving mine down at Horseshoe Basin, and the men occasionally would go down there and work, maybe for months or all winter on end, coming home every week or double every other week or something. And this was another way to make money. You had to have some money. Worked for the Forest Service, as I mentioned, and those kinds of things in the summer, and trapping. There was always trapping up there. The old trapping areas, certain people just sort of knew this is our trapping area and you didn't get into somebody else's.
Yeah.
Incidentally, there's some incredible stories about physical feats of going distances and doing things in the winter up there that you just simply can't believe, except that was just what you did, and you did it, that's all.
Why would you have to go great distances in the winter at all?
Well, trap lines were made to go about as far as you could go in a day. Or you had a cabin someplace that you got to. If you had a big snow in between and going was hard, you had a hard time making it and so forth. So, and there were cabins that people went and stayed in for a long time at a time. Upper Company Creek was one of the Courtney cabins. Been various cabins there. Snowslide took one out. Up until recently, when the last one was burned because of the wilderness laws, there's always been one up there. There used to be one up Agnes a ways and others around.
How far could you go in a day?
Opie Maxwell was one of the fellows up there who could, except for Lydia George, out snowshoe anybody in the country. Lydia George, believe it or not, a short lady and heavy set, could outdo him, I think. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. But Opie Maxwell lived 10 miles up valley, and he would start out, one of his trap lines was, he would start out early in the morning carrying a lantern so he could get an early start. And he would figure to get to the base of the mountain where he would hang his lantern at daylight so that he had both hands to get up the mountain. And he went up the V of the valley just below his house up toward Rainbow Lake. Very few people even this day go up there even in the summertime. It's a difficult climb. He would go up there and over that little pass and run his trap line in the valley up there, and in hopes to get back down to that lantern before dark. And to do that now in the summertime when you don't slip and slide is an incredible feat.
Yeah. And he did it on snowshoes. How often would he have to do that on a trap line?
Well, they did it every few days. It's cold, so what you were caught would keep a while, but also he didn't want other animals to get it out of the trap.
Yeah.
So you just did it every few days. And if a big snowstorm came, you had to wait till the avalanche time was over, and the old-timers had a sixth sense about avalanches. They just knew when not to go somewhere, that's all.
Yeah. Amazing. We're talking this morning with Bob Bird, live from the Apple Cup Cafe, and we will come back and talk some more with Bob in just a minute. Thank you, Steve. Bobby, we were talking to us about some of the interesting times and people that you had and knew in the Depression years. I think since the Winds of War has been on television, the World War II era is on everybody's mind these days. But there again, in this end of the valley, a lot is known about what people did. There were civil defense programs in the city, and there was a boat posse and a horseback posse and all kinds of things organized, that kind of thing. For instance, on December 7th of 41, were there enough radios with decent reception in Stehekin that did folks know that we'd been attacked?
Well, I wasn't in Stehekin. We left in 1939. I put in my 8 years at the log school, and we had moved out, and I was going to high school in Wenatchee then. I sure remember that day down there. Mm-hmm. All right, but I wasn't at Stehekin then. But the war years at Stehekin just brought things tourist-wise and the visitor type of thing pretty well to a halt. There was some, but there just wasn't much. The thing that continued up there was the Holden mine was a copper mine, and copper was needed for the war, so there was a big push to get out lots of copper. It was subsidized, and of course, some of the people who lived in the valley worked up there and hence stayed out of the war, or were doing things like running a sawmill. Courtney's had a sawmill, and they were finishing timbers for the mill. So part of the Courtney's were working up there. They got deferred from going into the service because of this. Mm-hmm. However, there was a certain incident that happened that got one of them right into the war because of this.
Would there have been any visible impacts in lifestyle created by the war up there as there was here? Was there any kind of civil defense program or anything like that?
I don't know about that. I wasn't up there then. I know that there was incidents about planes flying over, or some of them crashed up there. There was a balloon got loose and was caught up there. I think it was one of the Japanese balloons landed up there. So there was people looking out for these things. Some of the old planes are still lying in the brush up there.
That's an interesting thing that you mentioned, because there was a concentrated effort by the Japanese to use the jet streams and send incendiary devices here by balloon. But over the years, I've heard two different things. I know the official story was that the balloon that came over the lake and into that area was an old barrage balloon that had gotten loose from the Boeing Company grounds. But yet one also wonders if that might have been the cover story for having discovered one of the Japanese balloons.
I don't know that.
At any rate, I think the information that was published was that it was a barrage balloon. But at the time, that was supposed to be one of the better-kept secrets of the war, was that we knew those balloons were coming, so they would have needed cover stories to publish if it weren't either. You mentioned school days. Must have been an experience to go to school in Stehekin.
school days at Stehekin are the golden years in my memory. I like school. I also like to get out of school, but school was something that I was learning things and I was excited about. Particularly after about the seventh grade, we had a change of teachers, and she brought in the first library books, and we got a whole bunch of them. And that's when I first read the books by Bird Flying Over the North Pole and great exciting adventure stories like this. And incidentally, I got the biggest push to my history then when I began to study European history and more of those type of things. And I was excited about those things, so I was learning lots of things.
How did school operate? Did you go through 8 years of school there?
Yes. I started in 1931, and there was a new teacher that year, Mrs. Shaw. She was a widow, and she had her boy with her some years. So she taught there during my first 6 years, and I didn't know that there were any other kinds of teachers. She had to leave at the end of her sixth year because her sister was quite ill, and we got a temporary teacher who came in from the big city, and were we ever brought up short. I remember, for instance, one of the students starting to hiccup in the class, and quite loudly, maybe a little bit on purpose, but she turned around and said, "Who's doing that?" And when she found out, she just simply said, "Stop it." And lo and behold, she stopped it.
It's funny what fear will do, you know. One teacher for how many kids?
Well, I don't think there were ever more than eight kids during those 6 years. In the last year, my eighth grade, there was only four of us, myself, my two sisters, and one of the Buckner girls. So that then when we moved out, and the Buckner girl moved out also to go to high school, the school was closed then for a number of years. We were the last students then until, quite a few years. The part of the building fell down, the old woodshed in the interim, and so on. I would have to do some checking to tell what happened later on, but that all ended then.
Bob, in the old one-room schoolhouse that I went to school in, each of us had our housekeeping duties at the beginning or the end of the day. Somebody had to carry water into the bubbler, and other folks had to sweep the floor, and somebody else had to clean the erasers. Did you do that kind of thing, too, to help keep the school up as the year went on?
Oh, yes, we all had to do these things. And remember, we had the aluminum water bucket, and it was all one piece, no seams in it. We used to go over to Rainbow Creek and get a bucket of water. In the wintertime, it would freeze in the bucket overnight, and that bottom of that bucket got gradually to be so round you couldn't hardly sit it down. It'd tip over all the time. Eventually, we had to beat in upon the thing severely and get it back into shape. I remember in the wintertime, the creek would freeze over maybe 2-3 feet thick, and then quite a job chopping a hole into it to get water. And the racers, yes, I remember beating the racers. Teacher did the splitting of the wood and sweeping of the floor, however. I'm amazed to come up to the same old school now and find that the teacher doesn't do any of those things, and I guess the students don't either. Now they have a paid janitor that comes in, and you have paid helping teachers to come in, and you go on field trips where it's a part of the school day. You go out, learn how to milk a cow, believe it or not.
Yeah.
We learned all about that before we went to school and after we got home.
As trades change, I guess the education system changes along with it. It seems as though, as we were mentioning earlier, cutting wood was a very big part of the day through the wintertime there because you had to keep warm. What was there ever cabin fever on the part of a youngster growing up there where the winter would be long enough and heavy enough that you just wanted to bust loose and get outside?
Well, we were always skiing to school, and I didn't know what cabin fever was. Everybody actually got out and did everything in the wintertime. Just something everybody did. We used to even have ski parties on weekends. Especially when I was about 10, 11, and 12, the whole valley would get together. I remember that the only person who did not ski was my Grandpa Courtney. He still went on snowshoes, but even my grandmother would come down there, and she didn't ski, but she never could get around very well, but they got her down there, and she'd do cook up lunches right out there where we were all skiing. One of the ski places is right where Lena Buckner's house is now. Mentioned about how come that they wrecked our school place, our ski place, by putting their house there. Not really, but that's one of the places.
Did people make their own skis in those days?
Yes, that was another project. Everybody was experimenting how to make a better ski. My dad was handy with woodworking tools, and he loved to work in wood. And he was always making skis. Another thing he always was making was bows. He loved to make bows. The Courtneys were making skis. Everybody was making skis. Made them out of maple or different varieties. I remember my first store-bought skis were hickory. What a fun thing about the store-bought skis.
Yeah. Were the store-bought skis better than the homemade ones?
I don't know if they're any better, but they were store-bought.
Okay, you can tell me then. How did you get the bend at the end of the ski?
Well, you heated him in hot water, soaked him in hot water, and then actually in steam until you got them bent up the first time when you were making them. But usually, as you use them over winter, or especially by the time of the next winter, they would slowly straighten out somewhat. Mm-hmm. And we simply warmed them up with a blowtorch. You had to be careful not to scorch them, but put water on them and pet them down with water and put the blowtorch on and at the same time start bending them. You build a little form to squeeze them down as you did this. And it didn't take but just a few minutes to get a nice, good, new bend in them. And after it cooled off, it stayed there.
What would happen if you bent it too much? I mean,
well,
did it affect the performance of the ski?
Well, you could crack it if you bent it too much. That's okay. One reason why they just are bent about so far, or were then.
Yeah. Bob, we've covered a lot of ground here today. We covered an awful lot a week ago, too. Do you have any favorite stories that you'd like to get into?
One interesting story, little known about, clear back to the beginnings up there. Fact is, it was the year 1889 when they first had the first boat on the lake, and more had just arrived there, the year of the big forest fire. But there were miners in the area in that time. But one day the boat was coming down the lake, and they saw somebody waving along the shore where no human being had ever been. And they went over there and picked up this man who was just about starved to death. And he told what everybody thought was a wild tale about finding a mining claim somewhere up in the hills. He told everybody about this. And everybody sort of halfway believed him and halfway didn't. Anyway, he left the country and they got him a few clothes to put him together and fed him. And he headed out for California. Next spring, that guy was back again. This time he had found somebody to come look at his mine and maybe buy it from him. Financiers. So he brought these fellows up from California and he got them all.